Your check, your cooperative. As a farmer-owned lender, Farm Credit Mid-America shares the success of the cooperative with our customers, which is why we've returned more than $1.25 billion back to our customer owners over the last 8 years. It's proof being a part of our cooperative pays. Patronage is an annual decision made by the board of directors to return earnings to eligible customers. To learn more about patronage and eligibility, visit fcma.com/patronage.
Grab your pitchfork, light your torch, and get ready for inciting a riot. Conventional thinking has been warned, because we're going to gather, and we're going to march, and we're going to blow its f***ing house down.
Hello, rioters, and welcome back to Inciting a Riot, the podcast. I would be your left-wing dirt-worshipping host, Firelight. You know, the witch is a curious figure, existing in a uniquely liminal space of both fact and fiction. This world in the next. Many practitioners of magic walk a path that carefully stays in that middle ground, but a few heed the call to peek beyond the hedge, to walk amongst ancestors and spirits and gods and beings for which we don't yet have names. It can be daunting to leave that comfortable middle path, but Christine Grace, my guest today, and her new book, The Witch at the Forest's Edge, provide a gentle, encouraging hand to hold as you take your first steps past the hedge into the world beyond. The advice is practical, grounded in a practice that begins with what you have on hand and in your surroundings, includes discussion of ancestry and the many ways that family is made and found, and includes a deeply appreciated section on magical ethics. This book is practical, fresh, and will help guide a whole new generation off the well-trod path to embrace the old, wild magic found beyond the hedge. I hope you enjoy today's interview with the author, Christine Grace.
Christine Grace, welcome back to Inciting a Riot. How are
you? Thank you. Oh, thank you. I'm so happy to be here. I'm doing well. How about you?
I am so good. I'm so good because I get to celebrate The Witch at the Forest's Edge, 13 Keys to Modern Traditional Witchcraft with you, which is the book that you wrote.
It is. This is the book that I wrote.
This is the book that you wrote. Oh my gosh.
I wrote
Congratulations.
A book.
It's everywhere and everyone seems to be loving your book, which is, I knew that was going to happen because I got to read the book a while ago, and I fell in love with it hardcore and had a lot of imposter syndrome after reading your book. And I was like, maybe my book sucks.
No. Oh, my gosh. There's so much room for both of these books to exist
I know. I'm just crazy because your book is so freaking good. So for people that don't know you or know your platform, tell us a little bit about you and how you came to be the witch at the forest's edge.
So I have a podcast called Betwixt and Between, and I am Betwixt and my co-host is Between. And so we've been doing that for a crazy long time. Like, my 8.5-year-old was a baby taking naps in the afternoon and we were recording then. So it's been a while. You can also find me on social media at A Witch Betwixt. And so kind of the way this all came about is I've been part of a tradition for quite some time, and we needed to kind of refresh our teaching materials. We've always kind of taught in an idiosyncratic way, and there just wasn't anything. We recommended a lot of books, but weren't able to kind of use a book as a foundational text, and so we always had to write our own material, and it was just time for a refresh on that. And so I did it. And then it was a book. And the tradition is called The Forest's Edge. So my editor at Wiser thought The Witch at the Forest's Edge was an evocative, metaphorical title that just sounds kind of like enchanting and witchy. And so here we are, The Witch at the Forest's Edge.
It's, I mean, it's a beautiful book, but it's the kind of book that immediately made me think of myself seeking out books as sort of a baby witch, a newbie witch, or whatever we're calling those witches these days. Yeah. But when I was new, I remember this sort of felt like the kind of books that were just starting to come out then, you know, that late 90s, early 2000s kind of period where people were wanting something else other than that sort of Wicca washed version of pagan publishing that existed at the time. And every now and then you would see a book come out that would kind of talk about the subjects in your book. And it's been a long time since those kinds of books have come out. And I haven't seen something like this in, well, at least over 10 years. So this is a very, very, very special work. If somebody is going and wandering the aisles or wandering the online aisles and picking up The Witch at the Forest's Edge, what kind of magic are they going to find inside?
The magic of animism and a life enchanted. My perspective is kind of a combination of drawing on ancestry and folklore and bioregional animism and kind of weaving all of these things together with a thoroughly modern perspective and trying to kind of go deep with that. So it is not a book of spells. There are amazing books of spells, both culturally specific ones and ones that take a kind of broader view and pull together from like a variety of sources. Those are amazing. This is just not that. It's more about how things work that creates kind of a structure, a framework to kind of plug in your own specifics. And spell work is the last chapter on purpose.
I appreciated that. That was a track that I took with my own work. And I see a few more authors starting to put out books more on theory and theology and spiritual deep dive than just here's 40 pages of theory and 150 pages of spells. And I'm so glad for that, because I think that our community has needed that for quite a long time. I think we've had I think that we've geared readers to not recognize a book as a magical book unless they open it up and it's 150 pages of spells. So I'm glad that there's now new phenomenal books out there that are gonna make people think a little differently and maybe a little deeper about magic and about the reasons they're on this path. And your book does that so well. Let's talk about bioregional animism for a second, because you do spend quite a lot of time, not only in your book, but in your social media presence, inviting your audience to enjoy, to discover the magic of the world around them. Was that something that has always been a part of your path, or is that something new as you began teaching?
So I think to an extent it was accidentally always a part of my path. But it was not a part of my teaching until maybe like 14 years ago or so. I lived in an apartment in Tennessee, and I was totally new to Tennessee. This was not where I was from. I felt really disconnected from the ocean because it was my first time living somewhere landlocked. I couldn't quite get my bearings here. It just didn't feel quite right to me. Simultaneously, I started working with an apprentice who lived in Florida, in a part of Florida where there are really, really just two seasons. And at the time, I was working within an older tradition where we really worked with a very traditional kind of pagan wheel of the year that most people are probably pretty familiar with. And so for him, it really didn't work because there were not four seasons. And for me, I was just kind of flailing a little bit because the seasons weren't exactly the same as in the northeastern United States. And so it was at that point that I started digging into the details of bioregionalism as a way to both ground myself in a new location and also simultaneously to try to help my apprentice kind of work with the creative tension of wanting to connect with some ancestral ways for him and also wanting to be true to where he lived and what his climate was like.
I want to also ask about, you know, you do also deal a lot with spirit work, specifically ancestry work. I know that when it comes to the queer community, a lot of us have ancestry that we don't necessarily jive with that well. And I don't know, I think that as online discourse has evolved over the years, I think a lot of people are discovering that, you know, they also don't love the concept of ancestor work. How do you introduce the concept of ancestor work, and how do you navigate the troubled waters of working with ancestors or honoring ancestors that, you know, might make you a little bit uncomfortable?
Yeah, I mean, I hope in the book I did make space for the complexity of working with ancestors.
You did.
Okay.
You did very much so. And I appreciated that quite a bit because I think that you got it.
Okay.
And
okay,
I think that a lot of authors and a lot of speakers that are just like, well, you just need to work with your ancestors.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, I don't think that you quite realize that that's a big old pill to swallow for quite a lot of people, my dude.
Yeah.
And not all of us want that. not all of us.
It happens on social media a lot, like a really like kind of quick kind of meme type thing that's like, honor your ancestors.
Yeah.
Which, you know, on one hand, cool. You do you. But also, boy, is that a complicated thing to just kind of toss off at people. Like honoring your ancestors is just obviously the same for everybody.
Sure.
And it's not. So when I'm talking about ancestors, I am talking about ancestors of blood and of spirit. So for some folks, those like DNA ancestor pieces are just too complicated to mess around with, to be honest. Or maybe not right now, but maybe later. Or certain pieces of that ancestry can be worked with, and certain pieces need to be kind of set aside and even intentionally kind of guarded against. But then that spiritual ancestor piece can also open up the idea of ancestry, even if the kind of colloquial meaning of ancestor, like your literal family tree, is not working for you. So so I know so many witches for whom spiritual ancestors really take priority over the ancestors of blood. And so spiritual ancestors can be folks like leaders in your community, whatever your community is. It can be, you know, folks who have worked for justice for various movements that you really resonate with. It can be folks who have practiced the kind of magic that you like to practice, who have embraced the terms that you identify with, who you've had, you know, close personal connections with, regardless of whether they're actually related to you. There are so many ways to kind of pull in that sense of connectedness, of being part of a community and connected through time and space to others, that doesn't necessarily have to be all about, like, who gave birth to you.
Well, and I like that you bring that up. You know, you see on social media every now and then people selling, like, you know, candles of, like, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, or candles of, you know, some social or civil rights leader or something like that.
Yeah.
And the thing is, you know, I think people think that those are, you know, sold as kind of a joke or a trinket or something like that. But I am obsessed with the idea of just taking those and sticking them on your altar and absolutely bring that person in. If that person was important to you, if that person helped pave the way for you to live the life that you get to live, Yeah, absolutely. They are just as much a part of your lineage, of your life, as anyone else. I mean, if somebody else, if somebody can be part of your ancestry, part of your lineage, I think that's probably a better word to say, even though those words don't quite mean the same thing. But if somebody is helped pave the way for you to live the life that you have and have a freedom that you have, or they cracked a door open for you that you now get to walk through, I don't see any reason why they don't have a space on your altar. I don't see any reason why they can't.
Yeah, I totally agree. I don't think those candles need to be a joke. Like, I think that's absolutely legitimate.
100%. Do you have a Britney Spears candle? I've seen those. I've seen those in the red cat suit. I've almost bought them a couple times.
I'm a little too old when Britney Spears was popular. In my age group.
These are lies. You look like you're the same age as me, if not younger.
I'm in my 40s.
No. Well, that's not old. Come on. Britney is for all.
That's true. Britney can be enjoyed by one and all. Absolutely.
Britney is for all. I want to go back because you touched on it and then I completely skipped over it, to talk about when we were talking about bioregional animism, and you said that you had an apprentice who lived in Florida and really only experienced the two seasons. And I know for me, my own communion with land-based witchcraft and work with land-based spirits or entities, that kind of thing, really came alive once I moved up north, and I did get to experience four solid seasons. But the thing is, I think if I know what I knew now and could go back and maybe coach my younger self, I could have had just as rich of an experience working with the land around me, as I have now. So for folks who might not live in that space, or, global warming is maybe taking away some of those seasons.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
Climate change is maybe altering your climate. How do you instruct the folks that either learn from you or follow your social media presence to engage with what they have?
Yeah. So I think it's a really important point to make that you really could have had absolutely as deep of a connection in Texas as you do now. And it is not a barrier. The only barrier is, like, at the time, my lack of flexibility in how to think that through. And whether you're living in a really heavily built urban environment, whether you're, living in a forest or on a farm, wherever you are and whatever the climate is, I would just suggest digging into some scientific resources, right? So it requires stepping a little bit away from some of the really explicitly pagan or magical, witchy focused resources, because you want to learn about the geology underneath your feet and underneath your building, right? And you want to learn about the plants that live around you, like really, really around you. There's so much going on with the soil and even the microbes in the soil, right? There's different animals. You can track the seasons yourself. You don't really need my book or anybody else's telling you on what day you need to celebrate a certain season, because you're the one who can keep track of that. You'll start to notice if you're choosing to pay attention. You'll start to notice, like, so here's an example for me. My seasons here in Tennessee do map pretty well onto both a four season calendar and onto the kind of neo-pagan wheel of the year, except sometimes they're shifted by like a week or two. So some of my friends and tradition mates who live in other parts of the country will also be similar, but like off by a week or two. And just taking that time to notice and jot it down. So when did the snow start to melt? Or when did you first see the first green thing peeking up, you know, through the ground? Or what, you know, whatever it is for you, just taking that time with observation where you are, and also not being afraid of resources that are outside of Witchland. But there are some really good ones even online, so it doesn't even have to be super difficult or hard to access. There are bioregional data, at least in the United States, and I imagine for other countries, perhaps, but in the United States, our government has bioregional data. And so that is a totally free starting point to figure out the language that's used for where you live. And once you know what that's called, what your region is called, you can start using those terms to search more. Cities usually have archives. So one of my favorite things, especially when I did live in a city, which is the vast majority of my life, this whole forest dwelling thing is really exciting, but it's pretty new to me. City archives are an amazing resource and free to access. So it does require stepping out of the comfort zone a little bit, but it's still, it can be very accessible. Oh, resources for children. So I homeschool my kids. I have learned so much through children's science resources, and it's accessible, and I don't need to have like a degree in that field to understand it. And that's absolutely valid in my book.
I really love that. And I do love, I mean, I look back at those days of mine with a kinder eyes than I think I did for a little while. But you're 100% right. You know, inside of Witchland, there are four seasons. And if you do not experience those four seasons, sometimes you can feel a little adrift. You can feel like, well, am I really going to get the full witchy effect? And the thing is, I love that there are some, what social media is able to give us beyond a headache is the ability to realize that there are witches that live in areas that look just like yours. And that you have just the same number of seasons. It's going to look like what it looks like for you. And the magic is tapping into that. And oh my gosh, I wish I'd been able to unlock that sooner in my life. But I'm so glad that this book is out now, because that will help a new reader to realize that. I think of your book, I think of Temperance Alden's book last year, you know, really helping new readers recreate a wheel, recreate what the magical landscape looks like for themselves. And I love that so much. And thank you so much for that. There is, you know, it's interesting to have a conversation with you and hear about things like, you know, the microbes and the soil and talking about the makeup of the world around you. You do have a heavily science appreciative bent in your work. And I wonder, because for a very long time, and you and I go back a ways, for a very long time, it was a pretty controversial thing, and it can still be in some circles, to incorporate physical science, chemistry, biology, geology, things like that, into craft, and to say, no, there's no separation. My appreciation and understanding of one informs my appreciation and understanding of the other. And you do it so beautifully in your book, a book that's about, that's about riding a hedge and meeting spirits and deeply magical work, is also like, but science is real. And that's cool. How do you balance that? How do you, and I think part two, surely at some point you've come in contact with a student or a prospective student or something like that, that was disappointed that you had that perspective. Because I think one of the things that we do when we seek out witchcraft is we want there to be a magical explanation for things instead of a mundane or scientific explanation, and realizing that those are often the same explanation is a hurdle for some people. So I know that was a lot to lob at you, but I'm curious on your thoughts.
Science is magical. And I think I talk maybe a little too much about wonder and enchantment. And I find like the more I learn that just increases my sense of wonder. And so I'm just a big nerd, I think, is the answer to what you're saying there. Yeah, I'm a big nerd. I really enjoy science but you know, I think the thing is that so much of what I do, for example, hedge riding, there's like an extensive chapter going into great detail about how to hedge ride if that doesn't come really easily for you, which for some people it does and some people it doesn't. But I absolutely believe that what's happening there is important. Simultaneously, I also think science is real. And I think that we who are kind of coming from that perspective are a growing force. I don't think people tend to be drawn to me if that's profoundly offensive to them. I think if you're coming to me either for mentorship or because you're interested in the tradition that I'm a part of, you probably have some sense that I'm going to nerd out and that I'm kind of coming from a both and. Like, I can come from a very analytical perspective and also from a place of deeply appreciating spiritual practice that really just can't exactly be explained. Yes, all of the things.
Well, and an appreciation of science and appreciation of just basic physical science understanding helps you do things like identify, oh, the clay in this creek bed can be dried out and used and turned into a this or a that, or, you know, the rocks that are here. I mean, you know, that they very much seem to, at least from your social media presence and from your book, seem to inform your witchcraft.
Yeah. And it matters. Like, I think, you know, so I think when a person, me, anybody, I think, it starts kind of getting into witchcraft, there's kind of your like first exposure and you're like, oh, neat. And then kind of as you progress, eventually you're kind of drawn deeper and deeper, or you're not, but for many of us, we are kind of asking to go deeper, right? So early on, you're told that you should ground. Okay. So now you've learned like some techniques for grounding. That's amazing. But like, what could your next step be? Your next step could be understanding what you're grounding into. So if there is limestone that's kind of the bedrock beneath the building that you live in, and that limestone was created from the bodies of ancient sea creatures, whoa, is that going to shift your experience of grounding, that you're grounding into this big, huge limestone bed beneath the foundations of your building. But actually, it's an ancient ocean. It's literally the bodies of sea creatures. And how could that inform your experience of grounding that you're working with in your practice? You know, and I think not everybody is necessarily interested in caring about that, but I am.
But the thing is, the way that you describe it and the way that you bring that conversation alive in your book, it does make people curious. It's that mysterious, you know, the witch at the forest edge, you know, hook of, I promise there's a different way of thinking of this that is going to get you excited and going to get you engaged. Speaking of that, maybe one of the harder chapters for me personally, just because I'm bad at it, and I don't like things I'm bad at, is your chapter on hedge riding. So for folks that don't know, what is hedge riding and why do you write about it in your book? and okay. Why am I so bad at it?
Well, we can talk about that later, but, well, okay. So hedge riding is a spiritual practice that sometimes goes by the term spirit flight. It might be the same thing as neo-shamanism, but it is a practice where the witch's spirit or part of the witch's spirit is experienced as leaving the body and traveling elsewhere into whatever area of the other realms you're trying to work in. And so the purpose of this spirit flight, it can vary. Maybe you're going to meet a spirit that you work with kind of on their own terms, in their own space. Maybe you're kind of seeking wisdom here, there, everywhere. Maybe you're looking to actually do some magic in an otherworldly space. There's so many reasons why you might engage in hedge riding, but whatever you're doing, your experience is of part of your spirit being elsewhere. And the reason it's in the book is because it's part of my tradition. It's a requirement for folks who are kind of on the path into initiation. We have a couple of odd requirements, and we do hedge riding and ritual possession in the tradition. And so I included them in the book, even though they're normally considered not an essential part of witchcraft. And I agree, they're not necessarily, but for us, they are. For me, they are. They can also be really transformative for the witch. So I found over time that although there may be some barriers to those kinds of practices that require a deeply, deeply altered state of consciousness, can also be very powerful and transformative for us. And, you know, while spellcraft and divination definitely require a level of an altered state of consciousness, the like massively altered states just yield such results that I felt like I'd be kind of shortchanging everyone if I didn't include them. And they're often not explained also. Like people
exactly.
kind of mention them.
Exactly.
Like, hey, I did some ritual possession, or you should hedge ride if you're a traditional witch. But like, how do you do it? And so for some people, it comes pretty naturally, but for so many people, it doesn't. And so just being practical about it is something I felt like I could bring to the table since I've done it with apprentices for so long.
I'm so glad that you did choose to talk about it, and that you talk about it so, so in depth, because for dabblers, if something like that happens, if they experience an altered state, especially like you said, an extremely altered state, you know what, it can be scary.
Mm-hmm.
It can be incredibly scary. It can be totally frightening, you know, to feel out of control, to feel dislodged, to feel, you know, out of body, or not in control completely of your body. And that you at least explain it to the point where somebody can feel comforted about that experience, and maybe even find some ways for themselves to safely experiment with that kind of work. So I'm glad that you talked about it. Another topic that I'm glad that you talked about, that I think some people are going to be surprised by the chapter itself, was theology. I feel like that word is a trigger for a lot of people, because when they think theology, they think Christianity. And then, of course, they always think of a specific, whatever specific kind of Christianity they feel personally burned by or whatever.
Right. Talk
to me a bit about the chapter, the work that you did in that chapter, and what you're hoping people take away from it.
No, I understand. And there are a lot of folks in our community who have been burned by one flavor of Christianity or another. On the other hand, folks in our community are having theological experiences. Folks do experience themselves as having relationships with deities. And for some, that is a very important part of their practice. And so similar to how I didn't want to leave it unsaid, like I didn't want to just imply it or assume it or be like, work with deities without kind of offering a framework, a space for really thinking about what it is you want and what it is that you personally are going to figure out for yourself in terms of deity related figures. And personally, I don't really work with any deities, actually. I work with local spirits who are sort of deity-like, and Mary, the Mother of God, as kind of an ancestral tie to my grandmother's, basically. But I don't actually personally work with any deities, although I'm cool with all of them. I will totally have tea with them. They're just not on my altar right now. But I'm a big nerd about theology. It's one of my graduate degrees. And so often we kind of throw around the names of deities in the kind of witchy community without necessarily having kind of a resource and a framework for guiding our thinking and going a little deeper. So I tried to do the best I could to create nothing too long or exhausting, but a framework for thinking through, you know, what makes sense for each of us.
I appreciated it because it felt like, I hate to be the guy that says this phrase, but it felt like an adult in the room, because you're right, especially on social media, people throw around the names of deities, it feels at times often that people are like trying to collect deities like Pokemon or something like that, and that certain people are just involved in these CW style teen dramas involving these deities, and I'm like, I don't know, man. I'm not going to invalidate your experience, but I don't know anyone. It feels more like drama than deity than a healthy relationship with a deity or a spirit of some kind. So I was thrilled when I read that chapter, because I'm hoping that the kind of audience that will pick this book up is going to be perceptive to say, oh, there's a framework. Oh, there's a guidebook. Oh, there's another way of doing this than just it's all gnosis and it's all this and that. And I appreciated that a lot, which actually guides me nicely into ethics. You talk a lot about ethics in the book as well, which is something that up until recently I hadn't seen in a lot of books. I'm so glad to have found it in this one as well. Talk to me a little bit about the importance of magical ethics. What do you consider magical ethics, and why did you find it important to put it in the book?
Well, it's in the book because, just like everything is in the book, because I needed it when teaching. And so something that came up, has always come up for all of the years that I have taught in any tradition. I've always been part of a tradition where there's not necessarily a really straightforward guideline to what ethical practice is. It's kind of complicated. There's some nuance there. And so especially novice witches will sometimes be like, but wait, are you good witches? And I'm like, very good. So then I wind up having to introduce some nuance into the conversation and hopefully open up some space for both being like, yeah, we don't have like a super clear prescribed set of rules here, but we do have some guidelines and like some structure for thinking through where you sit. And so that's what the book is trying to do also, which is just giving some space for how to think out through like where you want to position yourself as a witch, which might not be exactly where I would. But because the subject of, and I find this on social media, like a ton, I had the audacity to post something on social media once that allowed the opportunity for that particular technique to be used to do harm. Oh, wow. Was there people who had some opinions about that? So that's just a subject that comes up a lot.
I often find that those people tend to do a lot of magic with like Glade candles or something. And like, like not knocking it or anything, but like I don't know that you're the person I'm going to be taking a lot of advice on what I should and should not be doing in my craft thing. Yep.
Yeah.
I want to talk about your podcast. You have a podcast.
Okay. I
Betwixt
do.
In Between. What do you all talk about on Betwixt and Between? I remember when you all came out because I've been doing this a
I know. Time. Yeah. Yeah. You're one of like the true old timers. Not that you're old. You're younger than me. But like an old time podcaster. You were podcasting before we were. And that's been a while too. And now there are so many options and I love it. I am all about the richness and diversity of so many voices, but it wasn't always that way. And so it's pretty much me and my best friend talking about witchcraft. And it exists because there were not that many podcasts on witchcraft. And we would have these we both had little kids who were taking naps. And while our kids were sleeping, we talked to each other on the phone about grown-up subjects because it was very exciting to have a conversation that was like not about diapers. And and then eventually I was like, okay, so there's this thing called a podcast. And I think that we can basically just record our conversations with each other and make it go to the internet. And then people can listen to it. And we tried it and it did work.
So, it did. It did. And people love it. And you have a great show. And I remember being so excited because there weren't a lot of podcasts that were like one that had more than one host. A lot of us were, you know, sitting alone in bedrooms and sticking a microphone
Absolutely.
Really close to your face.
Yeah.
But two, you all offered a really interesting perspective as parents and parents of young kids. There were a couple of people that had podcasts that had parents that were or that were kids, but they were, you know, teenagers or adults by then or something like that. But you all had young kids. And I always appreciated that perspective. And you know, I'm always curious. I'm not a parent. I'm an uncle. I'm not a parent. And unless I can somehow get pregnant in the next few years, probably not changing. So I can't get pregnant. But the question that I see a lot is when do people introduce the concept of witchcraft to young kids? Or is that something that you have introduced to your kids? Do they help you in your craft? Do they have their own craft? Or the other tack that I see that people take is, just introducing their kid to all spiritualities and letting them choose, you know, how do you handle it?
Yeah, I get that question a lot. And I love answering it. So great. So for me, and this is so variable for different people because different families have different factors going on. Like it is so common for families to be interfaith, right? And so the person in the family who has a witchy practice, if they're parenting with a partner, that partner may not have a witchy practice. They may actually have some entirely different practice. And so then the family's trying to figure out like what the balance is going to be, how you're going to kind of fit everything in there. Are you going to fit everything? I mean, there's a lot going on. In my family, I am the one who has a lot of opinions about religion and spirituality. And my husband enjoys nature and likes places that look like fairies can live there. And so,
I like
you know,
your husband.
Yeah. So we're pretty chill about celebrating the seasons. And then our families are kind of culturally Christian, but not like seriously religious. And so we incorporate some Christian holidays in a fairly secular way. And so, yeah, my kids are involved up to a point. So when they were babies, the only time I could practice witchcraft because I was so tired all the time was when I had to be awake anyway, because the baby was awake. And so I would just wear them in a baby carrier and do what needed doing. And so they were kind of immediately exposed to sort of the energy of being in ritual space, doing magic-y stuff. And then as they got older, I started integrating things that little kids like to do. Like, kids love making potions. They love it. They love to just like put stuff in stuff and stir with a stick and like, and then you tell them to like sprinkle it here and like sing a song. They're totally there for that. you know, so yes, they have always been involved to an extent. And as a family, we celebrate the seasons, most of the fairly traditional pagan holidays. We go big on winter solstice. So they are involved. However, there are aspects of my practice that are kind of just for me. And so, now that they're like not tiny babies who have to be like physically attached to my body all the time, I really enjoy just doing, and I always have as much as possible, enjoy doing some just like grown up witchy stuff. And I'm not going to do things like hedge riding with my kids around. That would freak them out. So
your 8-year-old isn't hedge riding. Your 8-year-old isn't flying off and talking to spirits.
No. But, you know, he certainly is sprinkling potions around the house and like lighting candles and, you know, celebrating seasonal changes. And hopefully, like, the overarching guiding philosophy that I have for my kids is a childhood of enchantment. And so whatever that involves, I'm good with. But there are parts of my practice that are really for me and for my spiritual niche. And I like to keep a little some things for just for me.
So you have one child that's 8 years old. So that means are they around? I mean, I know that you homeschool and the last 2 years have been in quarantine pretty much. So do they get around a lot of other kids that are not your like related to them? I was about to ask, while at school, do they? And then I remembered that they are not at school. They are homeschooled, which a lot of parents have turned to in the last few years, especially. But I'm curious, do they ever experience, you know, that having to explain what mommy does or explain their spirituality at home to strangers or something like that, or have to field those opinions?
Probably not as much as they would have to in school, because they would spend so much time around people that have no relationship to me at all. Mm-hmm. Because they are, my 8-year-old is the oldest. So because they are still quite young and they're not like driving places with their friends or whatever, like they spend a lot of time with other kids who are not related to us, and many of whom are not even particularly sympathetic to my spiritual practices, but we just don't hang out with people who would be hostile. There are a lot of factors in our life. In addition to me being quite a public witch, there are very important children in my life who have non-binary identities, for example, right? Mm-hmm. And so hanging out with people who are going to be hostile about either one of those things, just not doing it. So there is a certain level of, I guess, shelteredness, although they do hang out with other kids and other kids whose family have different practices. We mostly don't hang with the truly hostile folks. And I do try to kind of pre-explain things if I think it might be an issue. So that one handling that. I, the grown-up, handle that, not them being like, well.
That's good. I can't have a one-on-one conversation with you and not think back to the first time that you and I spoke, which was many, many years ago when I had you on my show to talk to a werewolf.
We did.
That's still one of my favorite conversations ever.
Do you still keep in touch with our werewolf?
I do. Yeah. He follows me on social media still. And he's
amazing.
The sweetest guy. He will listen to this. So he's the sweetest guy. Yeah, I think he's a nurse or something like that.
That's what I recall. Yeah.
Yeah, just the sweetest of guys. You met any other werewolves since
then? I haven't. Nope. No.
Oh gosh, I bring that up because, and I want to wrap up, but I bring that up because it was one of the first times whenever I got the opportunity to have a conversation where somebody is having a witchy metaphysical experience, like a hedge writing, like a therianthropy, I think is the right word there. Something that to an outsider is going to feel strange, or maybe to the wrong person, they might say something like, oh, you need to go, you need to be in therapy, or you need to.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
And
hedge writing is bananas for sure. Yeah. Sure. From the outside, totally nuts.
So for introducing the concept of mental health into magic, and the importance of having a check-in, with yourself, with maybe a professional, something like that. Do you have any tips for people on when to maybe do that? How far is too far for someone? How often should somebody be checking in? What does checking in look like? That kind of thing.
I think most of the time people know if their practices are difficult because maybe they're doing some pretty profound shadow work and it is bringing up some strong emotions. I think most of the time you know when something is becoming unmanageable for you and you are no longer guiding the process at all. And if your spiritual practice is eating you alive, then it's not working for you anymore. And that's going to require some kind of adjustment so that you are working your practice, not being kind of dragged around by it, and it can be tricky in our community. Well, one, all kinds of mental health, like professional mental health services, can be so expensive and difficult to access. So that can actually be super tricky to even.
Which I think is one of the reasons why people turn to metaphysical providers of pseudoscience services. There's a whole lot of, I did a conversation earlier this year on shadow work to explain what that is in the context of actual mental health counseling. I think there's a lot of folks out there that are trying to, that they can't afford services or can't access mental health services or might be afraid to access mental health services, but they're not afraid to, pay someone some money on Instagram to light a candle for them or give them a something.
Yeah. And I did not identify myself as a person who has a graduate degree in mental health counseling, but I'm a therapist. And, I don't think there's a problem with having someone light a candle for you.
And no, not at all.
And in many spiritual communities, spiritual leaders have some sort of like kind of light counseling role. Like in Protestant Christianity, that would be called pastoral counseling. And it's not the same thing as someone who can like diagnose and treat a mental illness, right? But there is a traditional role for spiritual leadership to kind of have a place there. However, it's kind of complicated, and a good leader who's providing those kinds of services should know when, like what their kind of scope of practice is, right? And that there are some lines that shouldn't be crossed unless you're actually coming from a licensed professional place. And so I'm a therapist, but I don't cross that line because I work as a witchcraft mentor. But I'm not crossing the line into acting like a therapist when I'm doing mentorship. So that piece from the kind of like guide or teacher or leader perspective is really important. And from your own perspective, I think like trust yourself when you feel like this is too much, I'm overwhelmed. We throw around the word triggered a lot, right? Like that word has like lost all meaning because kind of colloquially we just use it to mean anything. Like, you annoy me.
They were out of oat milk at Starbucks, and I'm triggered.
I'm so triggered. Yeah. So I'm, like,
I mean,
reluctant.
Personally, I am. But
no. So I'm, like, reluctant to even use it, but I mean it in the truest sense. When your physical bodily reactions are way beyond your normal bounds, your heart is racing, you're drenched in sweat, you can't calm your breathing, like, you cannot focus your thoughts, you are starting to leave your body, not by choice because you're hedge riding, but because your body is such an unsafe place that you can't, your consciousness can't stay there, you are truly triggered. And that is a place where you might consider looping in a professional in to help you with the tools to cope with those experiences. It is hard, though, in our community to find a therapist, too, who is going to understand what you do.
Absolutely.
So the way we're all taught, should be that if someone's spiritual practice comes from within a community, whatever you personally, the therapist, think of that is honestly irrelevant. And you need to keep that to yourself because this person is working within a community. So within our community, spells are real. People hedge ride. You can be a werewolf. Like, these are things that exist within a community. Are we a subculture or a set of subcultures? Absolutely. But still, this is a thing within a community. And so your therapist should be able to work within that framework. Can they always? Sometimes. It's tough.
Yeah, and I'm glad that you brought that up because it's important that everybody understands their role. You know, there's a place to have a sensitive conversation with a trusted friend. And sometimes a trusted friend is enough
so
of
important.
A vessel to hold mm-hmm. a tough conversation. But sometimes a trusted friend is not enough. And maybe you do need a leader. And a spiritual leader can absolutely fill a certain role. But then there might be a place where even that vessel is not enough. And so you need to go outside of that. And it is not doing anyone a good service to need one person to be all things to you. Mm-hmm. If it's not a failure to say, you know what, I cannot assist you here. I can support you, but let's find you the right person.
Right. That's it. Like, you can help provide those resources, right? Like, when something is kind of out of your scope, mm-hmm. you can help provide those resources. And even within a Christian context, like, I've been through essentially the training that Christian pastors have. And part of that is being able to connect folks to the resources when things are kind of beyond your spiritual caregiving.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Can I talk to you about things? Can I mentor you things? Absolutely. Can I diagnose you? No.
No.
Should I be pretending I can diagnose you? No, I should not. No, I should not. Oh, Christine Grace, it is a privilege and honor to get to speak with you. I adore the work that you do, and I adore The Witch at the Forest's Edge. I have taken up so much of your time, and you have been so gracious with that. Before we go, is there any one last thing that you want to make sure that people understand about the book?
No, I mean, I think we've covered a lot of the good stuff.
Yeah. Well, go get it. The Witch at the Forest's Edge, available online, available everywhere books are sold. Go get it. Go get it. Request it at your local library. I have been really trying to pump that up. You know, every now and then I'll see people say, oh, you know, I'd love to get this book or that book or your book or whatever, but costs money. I'm like, ask your local library to foot that bill for you. And then other people can read the book too. Put that into circulation. It's great. And plus the author is supported that way because it's a sale. So yay. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you. I love the work you do with this podcast, Firelight, and I'm always happy to be here.
Oh, thank you so much. It has been such a privilege and honor. Everybody go subscribe to Betwixt and Between. Go pick up her new book. Christine, if people want to connect with you on social media, how do they do that?
So I am at A Witch Betwixt on Instagram. Technically, I exist also under the same name on Twitter, but I really use Twitter to do reposts to Instagram. ChristineGraceBetwixt.com is my website, which kind of connects to all the things. Yeah, and that's how...
Are we going to lure you to TikTok?
I'm technically on TikTok.
Yes!
I've been thinking about kind of reposting some Instagram reels to TikTok. I don't know. We'll see.
You should do it. You should do it.
Same name everywhere.
Come enjoy the chaos. Always,
yeah. Oh, yeah. It is such chaos.
Thank you so much for being here.
Yeah. Thank you, Firelight.
Well, rioters, that's going to do it here for us today. I hope that you enjoyed this interview. Christine Grace's new book, The Witch at the Forest's Edge, is out and available now wherever books are sold. If you like this podcast and you'd like to support it, there are a number of ways to help. You can consider liking and sharing the show on social media. You can also rate the show 5 stars on Apple Podcasts or leave a review. Reviews really help to bump this up in the algorithm, which is the lovely thing that we are all beholden to in this day and age, and helps other people find the show. Help keep the show free and producing on a regular basis by chipping in whatever you can. You could buy me a coffee, which is a one-time donation of your choosing, or join my Patreon on a monthly basis. Patrons receive additional audio and video content, as well as archived episodes, a private Discord server, and monthly chats with special guests. You can sign up at patreon.com/incitingariot. Of course, my book, The Dabbler's Guide to Witchcraft, is also out now and available everywhere books are sold. You can find show notes for this episode or any other on my website at incitingariot.com. Email me about this episode or any other at firelight, that's F-I-R-E-L-Y-T-E, at incitingariot.com. If you'd like to connect with me on social media, I'm pretty much at incitingariot everywhere. Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, all of the things. Anyways, thank you all so much for tuning in. I'm going to leave you, but as always, I will leave you with love and light. Firelight.
You want your child to thrive and reach their full potential. K-12 can help them get there. K-12 powered schools are tuition-free, accredited online public schools for students in kindergarten through 12th grade. This is not your typical homeschooling. With state-certified teachers specially trained to teach online, your child will learn at their speed, at home, with innovative, engaging technology. Join the more than 3 million families who've chosen K-12. Go to k12.com/podcast to enroll today. Your child deserves an education that sets them up for success. K-12 knows that learning isn't one size fits all and has options tailored to each child's needs, interests, and goals for the future. K-12 powered schools are tuition-free, accredited online public schools for students in kindergarten through 12th grade. Students learn at their speed, at home, from state-certified teachers specially trained to teach online. Join the more than 3 million families who've chosen K-12. Go to k12.com/podcast to enroll today.